Bloomberg Surveillance with Ken Pruitt and Tom Keene. Listen on demand via our Bloomberg Radio Plus app. Now available free for both iPhone and Android devices.
Drew Mattis on the watch with UBS. They had a terrific year of forecasting, both in this 2012 and taking the trophy for Bloomberg Markets Magazine in 2011. He joins us with his crystal ball. Drew, good morning.
Good morning.
Can the crystal ball work tomorrow? Is it so messed up with a hurricane, you just put the black cloth over it?
Well, I mean, it is very much messed up. We are on the low end of consensus tomorrow. We're looking for plus 50. There's about 150,000 Hurricane Sandy impact and a 75,000 impact on a positive direction from the early Thanksgiving holiday. Mm-hmm. So we do have a bit of a mixed bag tomorrow, and it's probably more important for economists than it is for anyone else.
Well, I agree with that, but if I look at your gloom of plus 50 and I factor in, let's call it 120, from Hurricane Sandy, does that mean the real growth was 170, which is not a bad number?
Probably. I mean, you know, if you strip out the effects, you're probably looking at a decent number tomorrow. But the problem is, of course, that most market participants don't strip out the effects that's left for people like you and I. Everyone else just hits the buy or sell button.
Yeah, I'll go with that. But it is an improving labor economy. What will it do to the unemployment rate? You and Maury Harris have done terrific work on this mystery of labor participation, this debate of cyclical and structural labor issues. Should we be gloomy at 7.9%, or can we enthuse to a 6.9% statistic somewhere down the road?
You'll probably get to a lower number somewhere down the road. I think tomorrow, though, you'll probably see an uptick rather than a downtick. And so we're looking for an 8 on it. Longer term, you know, next 2 to 3 years, though, you know, you'll probably start pushing towards 7, and you'll probably get below 7. But the question is really, where's the natural rate at that point? And I think we'll be through and below the natural rate, which we peg at around 7.
Let me ask you the same question I asked Alan Greenspan moments ago. Folks, that interview, Bloomberg Radio Plus and Bloomberg TV Plus, and that is this idea of the new normal. Bill Gross reaffirmed in his note this week not only a subdued potential GDP, but the length of it out, I believe he used the phrase, a decade. You don't share that caution, do you?
We do not. I mean, you know, it's very... I think a lot of people put a lot of stock in the Reinhardt Rogoff arguments about financial conditions and what goes on after a financial recession. I think some of the examples they cite are not really relevant to the United States. I think, you know, when you think about the United States, you have to think of a few things. One is overall productivity, the strength of overall productivity. The second is ongoing population growth. And the third is kind of the mystery factor. You know, what has made America so exceptional over the years? And the answer is we create things that no one ever dreamt of. And I thought that was one of the best parts of Alan Greenspan's interview.
You listened?
I listened. I always listened.
Oh, my word. Rich, make a note. We're up to 47 people. Listen to Chairman Greenspan. Thank you.
Well, sometimes his mom
listens
too.
I just appreciate being called a person.
Well, economists get called
others. But seriously, he did talk about this mystery of American innovation. It was literally back to the Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's court.
I mean, if you look at the last 50 years and think about every major invention that's occurred, most of them have occurred here. Now, why is that? And this is why the tax debate is so important, because it's not just a debate about how we're going to pay for things. It's not just a debate about whether to tax the wealthy or the high-income earners more. It's really a debate about are we a country that's going to allow for the rewards of innovation? And I think, you know, we're in somewhat dangerous territory here. There's you know, a larger share of the tax burden falls on the wealthy than at any time in the last 50 years.
Right.
And we want to increase that. Well, I mean, you can do that, but I think that there are consequences, and unfortunately those consequences aren't entirely clear to everyone who's making the decisions.
Mr. Kinsley and I must have seen the different Downton Abbey. Let's rip up the script here. Lady Sybil, okay, the youngest daughter, folks, full disclosure, globally, crush. Okay, Lady Sybil is having a relationship with the chauffeur. Okay, so the idea that this is like a huge deal in, I think, season 2 of Downton Abbey. Shirley MacLaine is showing up this year. They've seen it in London. They're bringing it over here to the United States soon. Is the assertive mother of her ladyship. I can't remember her name right now. It's a beautifully acted part. It's a full op-ed here. I completely disagree with Michael Kinsley. I think Downton Abbey is wildly entertaining. It's not perfect, and I'd urge you to watch it for the craft of it. The way it's made is beautiful, and I will get off my Downton Abbey stool. And Lady Sybil, if you're listening, that would... Good morning.
Call Tom.
Call Tom. 1-800. Right away.
Yeah.
Drew Mattis. Oh, go ahead, Mike, please.
I just wanted to point something out before we get to Drew, and Drew can obviously comment on this as well. The controller for New York State, Thomas DiNapoli, just released a new report. If Congress fails to act on the fiscal cliff, it will cost New Yorkers $43 billion. Obviously, your paycheck would immediately go up. $7.7 billion in the payroll tax. But here's the thing. An additional 3.4 million New Yorkers would be required to pay the alternative minimum tax.
Yes,
would cost them an average of $5,180 a piece.
Perfect intro. Jessica Brown Finley, the actress for Lady Sybil. Drew Mattis with us from UBS. Drew, I'm so glad Michael brought that up.
We were talking about Downton Abbey. I mean, I got all excited for a second.
Oh, what, do you watch Downton? I think it's great.
One of two shows I watch. I won't say the other one.
Michael was just way off the mark there. And, you know, Lady Sybil, again, if you're listening, I'm available. but the AMT, Chuck Schumer's right about this. The AMT is a tangible lean over the desk check you have to write out, isn't it?
It is. And you know, one of the things that's often lost when we talk about the Bush tax cuts is the fact that a lot of upper-income people didn't get the magnitude of tax cuts that's often discussed, in part because they fell into the new AMT structure. And you can see that in the data. You know, if you go back to 2002, 4% of upper-income people were paying the AMT. By 2008, well after the Bush tax cuts were fully in their way, 48% were paying the AMT. Right? So clearly, you know, the so-called Bush tax cuts for upper-income people, it's debatable how big of a tax cut that really was.
I don't normally make political commentary. I'm going to call this geographical commentary. It seems to me that if you just have a... And Warren Buffett made this same point. If you just have a cutoff and say anyone who makes $250,000 or more is rich and should be taxed more, does not take into account people who live in very high tax, high expense areas like New York and San Francisco. And the president sounds a little bit out of touch when he talks about that.
Well, you know, there's certainly an irony. Bear in mind that the people in those states elected him, so they knew what they were getting into, right? Part of the reason the Constitution, I believe, decided against an income tax as a means of raising money for the government was because our founders were very smart people, and even back then they understood living in New York was a lot more expensive than living in, you know, the woods outside of Pittsburgh. There was a reason why the tax structure was set up the way it was in the Constitution, and then, you know, you fiddle with it enough and you end up with a situation like this. But, you know, we should also bear in mind that there's an irony here that John Boehner's trying to prevent taxes from going up in blue states. You know, I mean, honestly, you know, I'm not really sure what they're thinking. I mean, you might just say, you know what, they should just let taxes go up and they should let the blue states bear the brunt of it. And
keep saying this is your fault. Hey, I got to turn the question back to the economic data. Here's a question if I'd had more time, I wanted to put to Alan Greenspan. Central banks have put trillions of dollars out there. For the last 3 months, the core PCE inflation measure has been running at 0.9% on an annual rate. Do we have a deflation worry coming back? And if the central banks can't raise inflation, who can?
I wouldn't worry about their ability to raise inflation. I'm not worried about the three-month movement. There have been a lot of moves in energy prices, which would have pulled those rates down. You know, one of the oddities has been really what's been going on with rents in the CPI versus what's actually going on with rents in the real world. So I think as time goes on, you know, you have to think of it as if you have two glasses, and one glass represents the amount of goods and services produced in the economy, and the other glass represents the amount of money in the economy to buy those things. We now have a bucket on one side, and we still have the glass on the other. Those two have to equal. And so, you know, when people talk about inflation being a monetary phenomenon, it's too much money chasing too few goods. And I think that's the situation we'll eventually be in. The question is a matter of timing and a matter of how big the bucket is by the time that happens.
You look at all this, I'm going to ask you the question, Drew, I've asked so many this week. Forget about aggregate economics. If you got 1%, 1.5%, 2% GDP, a certain portion of America is miserable. What portion of America feels like they're in recession right now where wage growth is?
Oh, I'm going to say half. I mean, if you think about the number of people who are working in jobs that are, let's call it medium to low skilled, and then if you look at people who are in potentially high skilled jobs that are just in sectors that are not doing so well, you can probably, some of your listeners are in that bucket. You know, it's not great. Now, I mean, it's most acutely felt by people without employment, but the people who are employed are, you know, broken down into various buckets, and some of those buckets are doing better, and some of those buckets are doing worse. That's just the nature of the system that we operate in. There's nothing necessarily wrong with that. What you'd like to do, though, is obviously move that number from 50% down to 20%, and then you get a massive push.
What will you look for in tomorrow's data?
I mean, I'd like to see the earnings numbers move higher. I think that would be helpful. I would also, I'll also be paying very close attention. Something we pay very close attention to is the differential between high-wage job growth and low-wage job growth.
Interesting.
Because we don't know what the real number is, right? And even if you strip out all the different effects, there's still going to be some variations and things to think about. But what has typically happened is if you see good jobs numbers, it's because we're creating low-wage jobs. And the reason that's happening is because we have a lot of people who've been out of work for a long time. Their skills have eroded. Those are the jobs that can be filled most easily. When you create a lot of high-wage jobs, the overall number tends to be lower.
Very good. Drew Mattis, thank you so much with UBS.
Listen to Bloomberg Surveillance weekday mornings at 7 Eastern on Bloomberg 1130 in New York or on Sirius and XM Satellite Radio Channel 113. Copyright 2012.